Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN, the Independent Voter News. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Ilya Soman, professor of law at George Mason University. Professor Soman's research focuses on constitutional law, property law, democratic theory, federalism, and migration rights. He is a renowned author who has been widely published in scholarly journals and featured in significant array of national publications and shows, including this one. In addition, Mr. Soman's writings have been cited in decisions by many state and federal courts, as well as the Supreme Court of the United States and the Supreme Court of Israel. He joins me today to discuss one of his most interesting books, Democracy and Political Ignorance, Why Smaller Government is Smarter. I have to admit, the title alone captured my imagination. So without further ado, welcome to Deconstructed, Ilya.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ilya, there are days I feel completely surrounded by political ignorance, and I'm sure some people probably think I'm a contributor to it. But you've obviously spent a lot of time researching the subject. Did it ever occur to you to just spend a few minutes reading conflicting posts on social media?
So I actually started on these issues before there was much in the way of social media. But obviously, what we see on social media is in some ways the tip of the iceberg of this problem. Ironically, it is likely that people who spend a lot of time yakking about politics on social media probably know more than the average voter in terms of just pure factual knowledge, but they may well be more biased even than the average voter is in the way that they analyze what they know.
Well, in all seriousness, how would you define political knowledge versus political ignorance?
Sure. There are many different approaches to it, and it depends in part on what you think voters should know, which there are different theories of democratic participation, which have different knowledge burdens. But to my mind, it's telling that even if all you want is the voters know very basic things, like what the branches of government are, what are the major government programs on which the federal government spends most of its money, which government officials are responsible for which issues, and so on. A high percentage, often a majority of the public, doesn't even know those things. So even if you have a relatively undemanding theory of what voters should know, it is very likely the majority of the electorate most of the time falls short of that. They don't know even very basic things often.
You provide some examples in your book that are shocking. Can you share a few of those with the audience?
Sure. So for instance, only about a third to a half of Americans can even name the three branches of the federal government: the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. The vast majority of people do not know that the lion's share of federal spending goes to entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security, and also to defense spending. On the other hand, they vastly overestimate the proportion that goes to foreign aid, which is only about 1% of the federal budget. But on average, voters tend to think that it's 10 to 20 times greater than that. And often they're confused about which officials are responsible for which issues, and what things incumbents can affect or cannot affect. So for instance, I'm not the biggest fan of Joe Biden, but his approval rating has fallen greatly because of inflation, even though it's actually unlikely that he has much control over the inflation. He probably didn't cause it to happen for the most part, and there's little he can do in the short run, at least, to make it go away. But it has affected his reputation, and that's just not just him. Lots of data going back many years says that the biggest determinant of whether incumbents get reelected is short-term trends in the economy, even though they have very little effect on those short-term trends in most cases. On the other hand, they enact a lot of policies that have long-term effects on the economy, some of them very harmful, but voters rarely reward and punish incumbents for those because they don't understand those effects, they don't notice them. So if there are economic problems today, very rarely will voters say, well, that's because this flawed policy X was enacted 20 years ago, even though often that is actually the reason.
Now, are less knowledgeable voters more inclined to vote or less inclined to vote?
Probably less so. While the people who actually do go to the ballot box, about 50 to 60% of the eligible public in a presidential election, they're not actually well-informed, the people who don't vote are likely worse.
Are there any types of characteristics that demonstrate a stronger commitment to voting? Is there any correlation, age or income, things like that?
By voting, you mean going to ballot box?
Yes. Or casting a ballot.
So it is true, or yes, sort of casting a ballot, I should have said, whether it's in person or by mail. So yes, on average, people who are older and more educated and also people who are more partisan, that is, they have a stronger sense of loyalty to one party or another, they're more likely to vote. On the other hand, it is no longer the case that whites are more likely to vote than blacks or men than women. It may even be that women are very slightly more likely to vote than men.
Now, there are various schools of thought that the level of knowledge need not be complete. Can you speak to a few of those schools of thought?
Sure. Well, in one sense, this is obviously true. We never have complete knowledge of anything. There are probably no decisions that we make in our lives over which we have 100% perfect knowledge, and voting surely is not an exception to that. So I think almost everyone who studies this does not say that the only way to be a good voter is to have 100% complete knowledge of what goes on in government and public policy. However, I think what you really want to discuss here is that there are certainly some scholars who argue that voters can make good decisions even if they have very low levels of knowledge. And one of the most intuitive ways that could be true, although spoiler, I think it actually isn't true, but it could be true if, for instance, voters who know very little can use information shortcuts to make up for that. So maybe they don't know much about government policy, but they can still use what scholars call the retrospective voter shortcut. They can look, are things going well or are they going badly? If they're going badly, you vote against the incumbent, you throw the bastards out, and you re-elect a new set of bastards, but the new bastards know that the same thing might happen to them if they don't shape things up. And in principle, this can work even if the voters know very little about government policy and how it operates. But this example also illustrates the weaknesses of information shortcuts, that before you can reward or punish the incumbents for whether things are going well or going badly, you might want to ask, is the incumbent actually in a position to affect this trend? Or did this trend happen for outside reasons? And very often the voters end up rewarding and punishing incumbents for things they didn't cause while ignoring the things that they actually did cause. The best example of this is short-term economic trends, but you even get things like mayors are more likely to win re-election if the local sports team wins a championship, even though in most cases the mayor had nothing to do with it. Shark attacks are bad news for incumbents. In farm states, droughts are bad news. Farm production falls, even though obviously they rarely can the governor of Iowa, let's say, actually prevent the drought from happening or something of that sort. On the other hand, there are many kinds of subtle regulatory and spending policies that are actually very important in the long run, but that voters mostly ignore at the ballot box because they're not aware of them, or even if they do know about their existence, they don't understand their effects. So in order to use shortcuts effectively, often you need pre-existing knowledge that most voters don't have. You also need to be able to control your biases, which is perhaps something we'll talk about later in this interview.
Ilya, you use an interesting term in the book, rational ignorance. So help me understand rational ignorance.
Sure. Rational ignorance is a ubiquitous part of all of our lives because none of us have unlimited time and energy and mental ability to assimilate all possible knowledge that we could. So all the time we make trade-offs, even if implicit, about is it worth the trouble to read this particular piece of information or to go to a website and learn what's on it, read a book, learn what's on it, and so on. And often it's very rational to say, no, I'm not going to learn this information because it's not worth it. My time and effort is better spent on other things. And this is true for political knowledge as for other things. But when it comes to political knowledge, what is perfectly rational ignorance for individual voters can lead to harmful collective results. So the chance that your one vote will change the outcome of an election is infinitesimally small. In a presidential election, it's about 1 in 60 million. In more local elections, it's a bit higher, but still almost always only a tiny chance. So if your only reason to seek out political information is to cast a better informed ballot that hopefully will result in better government policy or better people being in power, that's not much of an incentive at all. And in most cases, it's rational for each individual voter to spend very little time seeking out information and thinking about it. However, if one individual voter does this, it's no big deal. It almost certainly won't have any effect. But if many millions of voters do this, it does have a harmful aggregate result.
Ilya, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about political ignorance when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Ilya Somin, professor of law at George Mason University and the author of Democracy and Political Ignorance, Why Smaller Government is Smarter. Ilya, when we talk about political ignorance and we talk about rational ignorance, there's an element of bias threaded throughout that. Can you speak to that issue?
Sure. Political ignorance is really a two-level problem. One is what we've already talked about. Most voters have very little incentive to seek out political knowledge, and they just don't know very much about what is going on in government policy. But there's a second level, and that is that those people who do seek out a lot of political knowledge, in most cases, they're not doing it for the purpose of being a better voter, because obviously spending a lot of time on that is, in most cases, irrational, given that it won't pay off. Rather, they're doing it because of other kinds of reasons. I like to analogize this to sports fans. Most people who are avid sports fans, they know much more about their favorite sport than the average person does, but they're not learning about it for the purpose of getting the unbiased truth about the NBA or about professional baseball or whatever sport they're fans of. Rather, they're doing it because they enjoy rooting for their favorite team, and often they hate the opposing team as well when there are rivalries like between Duke and North Carolina or the Red Sox and the Yankees and so forth. And you see much the same phenomenon with what I call political fans, people who really love following politics and government policy. In most cases, they know much more than the average voter does, but they're also highly biased in their evaluation of political information because they enjoy rooting for their favorite party or candidate or ideology. In many cases, they enjoy even more hating the opposing party and its leaders and ideology, and therefore, they tend to greatly overvalue any information that reinforces their pre-existing views while undervaluing anything that cuts against it. Much like if a sports fan is watching a game and the referee makes a close call against his team, the sports fan's reaction is likely to be, you know, that's terrible. The ref was obviously blind or biased. On the other hand, if the call goes in your team's favor, of course, that was a correct call. And the people I refer to as political fans are much the same way. So ironically, while the political fans are usually the best informed in terms of the amount of factual knowledge they have, they are probably even more biased in how they evaluate the information and do an even worse job of that often than sort of the average voter who cares less about politics and is not so much of a political fan. And it is actually rational to be a biased political fan. It is rational to be biased in the way you evaluate information if your goal in seeking out that information is not to get at the truth, but to achieve something else, like enjoying the fan experience, as you might call it.
Now, you use a very strong term. You use the term hatred for the team that is adverse to your beliefs. But there's also a bias in the way you look at your own party's performance or your own team's performance of which you're a fan. So how do people who are sycophants of a party evaluate their own party's performance?
So in general, they will tend to evaluate it very leniently. If something bad happens on the party's watch, they will tend to think either it didn't really happen, like maybe it's fake news or something, or if it did happen, it wasn't the party's fault. It was the fault of circumstances. It was the fault of the opposition and so forth. If your leader of your party has a scandal, there is a tendency either to think it wasn't a big deal, didn't really happen. The other side is worse. You see this certainly in recent years in reactions of partisan Republicans to Trump scandals, but there's certainly cases of Democrats behaving this way too. And I would add these problems become worse during periods of severe political polarization like our own, where, you know, precisely because you're very supportive of your party, or at least you very much hate the other party, you're going to be very reluctant to admit anything which implies that maybe your party or its leaders don't deserve to win. And you mentioned the word hatred before. Not every partisan goes so far as hating the opposition, but such hatred does exist, and it gets worse in periods of severe polarization. We are in a period where that polarization is greater than it has been in many decades. And you even have survey data going back several years now, for instance, where if you ask people questions like, would you be angry or disappointed if a member of your family married a supporter of the opposing major political party? Many more people say yes than if you ask them, would you have similar negative feelings if a member of your family married somebody who's an adherent of a different religion or a person of a different race or ethnicity or whatnot? You know, something like 30 to 40% or even higher of Americans say they would be angry or the like if a member of their family married a member of, or an adherent of, the opposing party.
You've also raised how people will take shortcuts. And one of the shortcuts is to default to a political opinion leader. Let's talk about the media in that case. What role does the media play in either tamping down the bias or exaggerating the bias?
So in many areas in life, rather than investigate a subject in detail ourselves, we rely on what scholars call opinion leaders. That is, people who we think know more about the subject than we do and whose judgment we can rely on. For instance, I rely on my pediatrician for the most part to decide what vaccinations my kids should get, because I think I very rashly have concluded the pediatrician knows more about the subject than I do and is probably likely to be right. Similarly, advocates of information shortcuts say, well, voters can do the same thing. They can rely on people who know more about government policy than I do and or than they do and just vote as those leaders dictate. But there are two problems. One is, because this is a decision where it's very unlikely that your individual decision will make a difference, when people choose opinion leaders, they often choose them not based on how effective those people are at getting at the truth, but rather at how well they cater to the pre-existing prejudices of the audience, how entertaining they are, and so on. If you look at, say, the opinion leaders on Fox News or MSNBC, those who are hosts of popular shows about politics, these are pretty obviously not people who are most notable for their deep knowledge of public policy and their history of correct predictions of what the results of particular policy are going to be. These are pretty obviously people who are catering to the pre-existing prejudices and partisan biases of the audience. And this is accentuated by the fact that we know that political fans, as I called them earlier, tend to overwhelmingly want to follow politics in media that supports their pre-existing views. If you're a conservative Republican political fan, there is a high likelihood that you watch Fox News or other similar right-leaning information sources. If you're a liberal Democrat, it's more likely to be MSNBC, NPR, and so on. But very few people do what John Stuart Mill quite correctly said you should be doing if you're a real truth seeker, which is that you should actually make a special effort to seek out information sources with viewpoints opposite to your own, because those are more likely to present you with arguments and evidence that you haven't heard before. Very few political fans follow the John Stuart Mill procedure. They're more likely to follow the Tucker Carlson or the MSNBC procedure of just watching entertaining sources or follow reading entertaining news sources that reinforce their pre-existing views.
In media, there's a strong incentive to exaggerate a position because it attracts audience and either maintains or grows shares. Is that correct?
Yeah, so people who run political media, they're well aware that the political fans are a big part of their audience, and therefore they cater to their prejudices. The incentives here are sufficiently strong that the surprising is not that there's a lot of bad or biased media. The surprising thing is that there isn't even more of this problem.
Ilya, we're going to take another quick break and talk more about political ignorance when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Ilya Soman, professor of law at George Mason University and the author of Democracy and Political Ignorance, Why Smaller Government is Smarter. Ilya, we've talked about some of the challenges that we have with political ignorance. So you've pretty much shattered all hope for any of us for having a good voting experience. But there are some possible solutions. One of them you and I've talked about before, based on another book that you wrote, Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom. Talk about the ability to vote with your feet and why that's potentially one of the solutions, at least at a local or state level.
In this book, also in chapter 5, I talk about how voting with your feet can reduce the problem of political ignorance. And let's talk about what voting with your feet is. Generally speaking, there's more than one way that we can choose what government policies we want to live under. The most obvious one is you go to the ballot box or you vote by mail and you choose to vote for a particular candidate or party. But another one is voting with your feet. You can choose what city or state to live in, based at least in part on government policy. You can even choose to move to a different country entirely if immigration policy will let you, because you like that country's policies better. And when you vote with your feet, you have much better incentives to both seek out information and evaluate it rationally than when you vote at the ballot box. For instance, if you're like most people, you spend more time and effort seeking out information when you decide what television set to buy than when you decide who to vote for in any election. That's not because the TV is more important necessarily, or that it deals with more complicated issues. It's because you know that this TV set you choose most likely will actually end up in your living room and you'll get to watch it. But if you flip on the TV and you see the president or any other powerful politician, your chance of being able to affect who that is or what policies they follow are infinitesimally small. So you devote much less time and effort to that particular decision. So if we decentralize government power, or even leave more decisions to the private sector where you can also vote with your feet, that will enable more decisions to be made in frameworks where people have better incentives to be informed. And similarly, there are various policies we can adopt to increase opportunities for foot voting, which I describe in much more detail in my other book that you mentioned, Free to Move. But I would add here also that if you reduce the power of the federal government, and even more, if you reduce the role of government in society generally, in addition to expanding opportunities for foot voting, it also reduces the number of political issues that ballot box voters need to pay attention to. And while they will still have only very limited knowledge, that very limited knowledge will not be as overstretched as it is at a time when government at all levels, government spending is nearly 35% or 40% of GDP in the US, even higher in some other democracies. And government regulates almost every aspect of our lives. And therefore, even relatively well-informed voters, they're unlikely to know enough to monitor more than a small fraction of all this activity. If government was smaller and less complicated, people would be able to vote with their feet more, but also the attention that they are going to devote to ballot box voting, it'll be somewhat less inadequate to the task than is the case at present.
You bring up an interesting issue when you talk about the size of government, because as I read the Constitution, the federal government is
not supposed to have the bandwidth of control
they've grown into. So if they actually followed the direction of the Constitution and delegated to the states under the 10th Amendment, are you suggesting that political ignorance would be reduced because people would have a more close relationship and then could exercise like foot voting to express their displeasure if their vote wasn't sufficient?
Partially. I'm not making the claim that you often hear that people become better informed about governments that are in some sense closer to the people. Indeed, when you look at sort of ballot box voting knowledge, people actually know less about their local and state office holders than they knew about federal ones. So I'm not claiming people know more about, say, their state representative than they know about their congressman or their senator. What I am saying is that if more issues were left to local or state governments, as arguably is required by the original meaning of the Constitution, then people would have the opportunity to vote with their feet over more issues. And when people vote with their feet, they tend to be better informed about the relevant knowledge, which in this case is not so much knowledge about particular candidates, but rather knowledge about the general quality of government in different jurisdictions, economic opportunities, housing, and other things of this sort, taxes. People do tend to make relatively well-informed choices about that if given the chance, even if they don't know much about what their governor is doing or what their state representative is doing. And, you know, I think obviously there's debate about this among legal scholars, which we could take up at another time. But I do think that under the text and original meaning of the Constitution, the role of the federal government is supposed to be significantly smaller than it currently is.
Now, we have ideological segregation among the states. We have red states and blue states where a person from the opposing party has a very limited chance of success. Would foot voting exacerbate that? Would it lead to more polarization with people gravitating if they were a Republican moving to a red state, a Democrat moving to a blue state? Or is that not a factor?
Some people do worry that if we had more opportunities for foot voting or more people did it, you would get even greater polarization. You would get what a famous book calls the big sort, that sort of all the really conservative Republicans would live together and all the really liberal Democrats would congregate together and so on. When you actually look at foot voting patterns, I think this turns out not to be true, that the things that lead people to vote with their feet are often not sort of purely red versus blue differences. Rather, you see things like people vote with their feet for lower housing costs and lower taxes, which may be associated with red states, but they also tend to vote with their feet for more diverse and more socially tolerant jurisdictions, which may be associated with blue areas. Indeed, some of the biggest attractors of foot voting places like Houston and Austin are actually blue cities in red states. That seems to be a combination of policies that attracts foot voters. And if you look more generally at the state of Texas, which in recent years has attracted probably more people migrating from other states than almost any other, you see that those people are almost equally divided between Democrats and Republicans, which gives the lie to the notion that, you know, all the Republicans are moving to Texas, whereas all the Democrats are moving to California or something like that. That isn't what's happening. In part, that's because people do a better job of evaluating foot voting decisions and don't just put on partisan blinkers when they do that in the way that they do at the ballot box. I would note, however, that some degree of ideological segregation isn't always a bad thing. We wouldn't want a country where every state or every locality has exactly the same balance of Democrats and Republicans, conservatives, liberals, and so forth. We would want some variation in that so that people would have a wider range of options. What Heather Gerken, the dean of Yale Law School, she calls the second order diversity. That is, we want diversity not only within particular institutions, but also diversity between institutions, such that some of the institutions are quite different from others.
Very, very quickly, we have a limited amount of time left. Talk about some of the novel approaches of paying voters to attract different people or restrict the franchise.
So restricting the franchise is a very old idea for dealing with the problem of political ignorance. The theory is, well, we simply ban ignorant people from voting. Or John Stuart Mill suggested we give the knowledgeable extra votes. So he had a scheme where if you had certain educational credentials, instead of having just one vote, you might have two or three or four and so on. In principle, you can argue for this, but I think obviously historically, what we found is that governments can't be trusted to do this objectively. That governments, they will actually tend to do is try to skew the franchise such that their supporters are eligible, whereas opposition voters are not. And obviously there's a history of racial and gender bias in this as well. On the other hand, the idea of paying voters to increase their knowledge, despite my attempts to attract more interest in it, it has attracted very little interest even from experts on the subject, much less governments. But in principle, I think it deserves more attention. The idea is very simple, that the government or perhaps a private entity can every year or every 2 years, however often you want, hold an event where people can take a test of political knowledge. And if they score well enough, they get a payment. It might be $100, it might be $1,000 or whatnot. And this will provide individual voters a significant incentive to increase their knowledge. Because recall, the problem is that voters are rationally ignorant. It's not rational for each individual voter to do more than a minimal amount of seeking out political knowledge. If you pay voters to learn, then it becomes much more rational. There are some problems with this idea. We might talk about it, but I do think it deserves more attention. And it's worth noting under this idea, nobody would lose the vote if they score badly on the test or if they don't take it. So there's not the less danger of disenfranchising people just because they're opponents of the government or something like that.
Ilya, where can our listeners go to learn more about you, your writings and appearances, and pick up a copy of Democracy and Political Ignorance?
So the best way to pick up a copy of Democracy and Political Ignorance, or really any of my books, is just to go to Amazon or another similar website. You could also go to the websites of my publishers. In the case of this book, it's Stanford University Press. In addition, I have a website of my own at the George Mason University website where I teach, where you can download many of my writings for free, though not Democracy and Political Ignorance, unfortunately, but many of my articles. And I also regularly write for the Volokh Conspiracy Law and Politics blog. Volokh is spelled V-O-L-O-K-H. It's hosted by Reason Magazine, and all the content there is also completely free. And I regularly write about political ignorance, foot voting, and also other related topics as well.
Ilya Soman, professor of law at George Mason University and the author of Democracy and Political Ignorance, Why Smaller Government is Smarter. I have to ask, do you think I should dumb down my show to appeal to a larger audience, or do you think it's too late since the parties have beaten me to it?
Well, I suspect lots of people have beaten you to it, but I think there is a large audience of people who are reasonably well-informed about politics. It's just that there is a much larger, still audience of people who are not.
Well, as always, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show, Ilya, and thank you for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you.